So my talk will be more on this mass renormalization and vacuum shift using off-shell string theory. I'll have strong overlap with the last talk, but after some point, the way we will arrive at the result will be very different from using the string field theory techniques. So let me first discuss almost the same thing which Ashok said. So we know that Polyakov prescription, where in Polyakov prescription that superstring perturbation theory is based on super Riemann surfaces, and the prescription for computing G loop endpoint amplitude is to insert vertex operators on a Riemann surface, or if a superstring super Riemann surface, and then you integrate over the moduli space. Okay, and here we are using the unintegrated vertex operators. That means we will integrate the moduli space will be moduli space of punctured Riemann surface. So the Polyakov prescription says that we use unintegrated vertex operators, which are conformal primary of dimension 0, 0. And this conformal condition gives you the on-shell condition, space-time on-shell condition. And to be more precise, it gives you the tree-level on-shell condition. Okay, but for massive states, the massive states receive a perturbative correction to their mass, and as a result, if we want to compute the S-matrix element, we need to modify this Polyakov prescription. Just to give you an example why this Polyakov prescription gives. It's wrong for massive states. Let's consider 4-point 2-loop amplitude, which is schematically represented here. And let's say the vertex operator V1 is a massive vertex. It's a vertex operator for a massive state. Then this amplitude has a particular degeneration where this node is going. This is a infinite cylinder or a node. And in field theory language, this is something like this. But in field theory, we know this part should not be there because this is a self-energy diagram, and the self-energy diagram is not a part of a S-matrix element, right? So if you use the naive Polyakov prescription, we get this self-energy diagram, which should not be there, which means that there is something wrong with the Polyakov prescription. And it creates some problem in doing so. For example, if you want to prove BRST invariance for, if you put one of the operators BRST exact, you will see that it gives rise to BRST anomaly, which basically says that the pure gauge mode don't decouple. And the BRST anomaly comes from this kind of degenerations, which was proved by Ashok Sen in 98. And also, in case of superstring, this creates an obstruction to prove supersymmetric word identities when one of the vertex operators are massive. So, one approach could have been one approach to find the exact mass for this vertex for these states could have been to just so let me say first, this problem is not there for massless sector, since massless sector for gauge invariance they do not receive any perturbative correction. So one approach could have been to just compute massless amplitudes, consider factorization, and look at the poles of the massless amplitude to determine the mass of the massive states, all other massive states in string theory. But this approach will give mass for many states, but it can't it will not produce the mass for all the states. For example, there is this SO32 spin-off states in heterotic string theory at the first massive level. Since this is SO32 spin-off states, it cannot be produced as a pole term. It cannot be produced as a pole term in the scattering amplitude of massless element. So you will not get this object. Moreover, if you consider a tolerably compactified string theory, and if you consider the massless scattering amplitude in the uncompactified, in the lower dimensional theory, you won't get these winding modes as well. I mean, you can't get the winding modes as a one particle pole in the channel from the massless scattering amplitude. Which means that you have to address this problem directly. You can't just rely on the massless amplitudes. Okay, yes?
Be possible to mock cats.
Yes, but that's much difficult because you have more cats and you have, in string theory, you have high degeneracy of states, right? So you have first the massless cut and then you have more cuts. So it's poll is an easier way. In principle, I think it's possible, but I think in practice it's very difficult. So in order to address this problem, let's look at the lesson we got from quantum gauge theory. And let's look at the problem of mass renormalization of W boson in electroweak theory. It's string theory is very similar in spirit, but like quantum gauge theory, spontaneously broken gauge theory, but yet we don't know an explicit realization of that idea. So, but anyway, we can look at the what we do for in case of W bosons in electroweak theory, and we will try to do the similar thing in string theory. So when you do, want to compute the mass renormalization for W boson, we compute the off-shell two-point function of the W boson. And this off-shell two-point function clearly depends on the particular choice of gauge, whether we are doing the computation in Lorentz gauge or tooth gauge or light cone gauge. It will depend on the choice of gauge. Then we determine the pole of this off-shell two-point function to find the renormalized mass. And there we find that the pole of the off-shell two-point function do not depend on the choice of gauge. Okay, only the residue at the pole depends on the choice of gauge. And then we go on and we use LSZ prescription to ampute the off-shell correlation function to determine the correct S matrix element. And the basic lesson we get is that we have to first consider an off-shell amplitude, and we want to do something which is similar in spirit in string theory. Okay, so as Ashok already has described, you can do it in superstring field theory. But one can understand this problem even without going into this superstring field theory. And the first approach we followed was this pragmatic approach. In this approach, we generalized Polyakov prescription without worrying anything about the string field theory origin. And the approach, pragmatic approach is basically to consider vertex operators which do not obey the on-shell condition, which means the vertex operators are not of conformal dimension 0, 0. If you throw away this condition, then this search and amplitude will not be invariant under the wild rescaling of the Wolschmidt metric. And as a result, it will start depending on the local choice of Wolschmidt coordinate near the vertex operators. Okay? And this approach is mostly based on many earlier works by these people. And just to give a pictorial representation of the fact, since let's consider again the two-loop four-point function, and let's say that these vertex operators are off-shell vertex operators. Since these are off-shell vertex operators, it will depend on the particular local choice of coordinate around that vertex operators. Okay, so that was also done by Nelson. So this off-shell amplitude will depend on the local choice of coordinate near the vertex operators. And in order to organize this spurious Wolschmidt data, because if we want to prove that everything is independent of the local choice of coordinate, we first need to organize this spurious Wolschmidt data. So the spurious this data, what we do is that we first choose a global coordinate, which we call a reference coordinate system in a Riemann surface, which can consist of several coordinate charts depending on a particular Riemann surface. And we also choose some local coordinates, and these local coordinates are these local coordinates are around this ith puncture, and there are some functional relation between the z coordinate and w coordinate such that the origin of the wi coordinate is mapped to some point on the Riemann surface on the global coordinate. And then the definition of the off-shell amplitude we gave is that we insert the vertex operators on this local coordinate. And this basically says that we do the conformal transformation of the vertex operator from the W coordinate system to Z coordinate system. Okay, and one can easily show that if we write the amplitude in this way, one can explicitly show that the amplitude actually doesn't depend on the Z coordinate system. It only depends on the W coordinate system. That's the motivation for us to define the global coordinate system and a local coordinate system, so that everything becomes insensitive to the global choice of coordinates, but it just depends on this W coordinate. And we can talk about just varying the local coordinate without worrying about the varying the global coordinate on the Riemann surface. That was the motivation to do this. And our goal is to show that any physical quantity doesn't depend on this spurious worldsheet data. So at this point, this thing depends on the W coordinate. But we will show that if we compute mass renormalization and then we use it to compute S matrix element, that will not depend on W coordinate. That's our end goal. Okay. So just to use using some mathematical terms, we are considering just the decorated moduli space, which is the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, and around every puncture you have a local choice of coordinate. This optional amplitude is a particular form integral of a form of this degree over a particular section, and a particular choice of section is basically a choice of local coordinate around the punctures. And the goal will be to show that the pole, and after that the S matrix element, doesn't depend on the choice of section. Okay. So before we go and prove this thing, we have one more problem in string theory. In this talk I'm considering just closed string theory, and in closed string theory, every order in perturbation theory, it has just one diagram. And in order to compute mass renormalization in quantum field theory, we know that we just sum over 1 PI diagrams, right? But in closed string theory, there is no concept of 1 PI diagram. A single diagram contains both the 1 PI part and 1 PR part. Again, to just illustrate that point, if you consider this the genus 2 Riemann surface, you can take this node going to zero size. And that's basically two genus 1 surfaces connected by a propagator. And that's part of the whole genus 2 moduli space. Okay. This can also be illustrated using this plumbing fixture construction. So let's consider two genus 1 surfaces. Just consider two point W1 and W2. And if you consider local coordinate around W1 and W2, and if you glue them along this, you will get a genus 2 surface. This is a particular part of the moduli space of genus 2 surface. Okay. And one more point, this construction, plumbing fixture construction, depends on the local choice of coordinate around the punctures. That will be very important for us later. So if you glue this using plumbing fixture construction, that's basically something like gluing two genus 1 surface with a closed string propagator. And to see the propagator, the more naive way would be to just do a conformal transformation, consider log W, then you can see it's like a cylinder, which maps to a cylinder. So we can always construct higher genus Riemann surfaces by gluing two lower genus Riemann surfaces using plumbing fixture construction. And whenever we can do that, we declare that part of the moduli space as 1 PR region, okay? But this plumbing fixture construction do not give the full moduli space, okay? And the rest of the moduli space, we declare it as 1 PI region. So what we are essentially doing is that we are removing a neighborhood of the separating degenerations from the moduli space and declare the rest as 1 PI region. Okay, yes?
How explicitly can you if you take a cellular decomposition of moduli space, mm-hmm. can you find one which, can you find a domain that corresponds?
So you're saying that what is the size of the neighborhood or?
No, I think you have a general constructive description of how to identify this.
No, it works like so. Its construction is like that. Let's you want to compute the mass renormalization for some particular state, which means you have to compute two-point function. So you start from genus 1, and in genus 1, when you do that construction in this off-shell formulation, you choose some local coordinate, and then using that local coordinate, you glue it to get a genus 2 surface.
I understood that. I'm saying if you want to identify the 1 PI part in the moduli space, mm-hmm. suppose you fix very specific coordinate. Mm-hmm. Is there an explicit construction of the 1 PI, the cell? Would be some kind of cell?
Once you choose the local coordinate around the punctures, I think we can construct the explicit difference between the 1 PI and 1 PR part. But that difference means that boundary, mm-hmm. will depend on the local choice of coordinates.
Yeah, yeah. This was discussed in fairly detail in the last lecture. And also Kevin suggested considering hyperbolic surfaces that don't have small separating geodesics.
Mm-hmm.
That's an explicit way to
do. Yes, right. So now it was also again discussed in the last talk. It's called Green compatibility, and Green compatibility is like that when the one PR Riemann surfaces, the choice of local coordinates should be induced from the local choice of coordinate glued by the lower genus surfaces, okay, and the local choice of coordinate in the rest part of the moduli space can be arbitrary, subjected to the continuity at the boundary. And this green compatibility condition is very natural in bosonic string field theory, but in this approach, it's something we put by hand. And this condition is important to ensure that the optional amplitudes satisfy factorization relation. So if naively, if we do say in first quantized formalism of quantum field theory, it's like that if we do second order perturbation theory in Lorentz gauge, and first order perturbation theory in Coulomb gauge, it's something like doing this non-Green compatible sections. So we consistently do the computation so that when you factorize this, you get the correct lower order amplitudes. Okay. And then we compute the optional two-point function. So if I'm first discussing how do you do the mass renormalization. You compute the mass renormalization. This is self-energy diagram where you integrate just over the 1 pi region of the moduli space. Kappa s is the string coupling constant, and this is the optional two-point function. And then to compute the renormalized mass, what you do is that, but it's same in like in quantum field theory, we compute the optional two-point function. We sum over the 1 pi diagram. We diagonalize if it's necessary. And then we determine the pole of this off-shell two-point function and the mass and the wave function renormalization. So I am not at present. I'm not discussing this subtlety because this is a subtlety in string theory because you have many states in a particular mass level. But let's first do the simplest thing. Let's say that you don't need this diagonalization, and this is the off-shell two-point function. And by looking at the pole of this off-shell two-point function, you can easily determine what is the mass of this particular state, right? Now in order to, so that's why you can do that computation. But now the question is that since everything depends on the local choice of coordinate, how do you prove that this mass, if you perturbatively determine the pole of this object MP in this propagator, How do you prove that this pole doesn't depend on the local choice of coordinate? Okay, and I'm going to illustrate that in three or four slides, and I will try to use as many as diagrams as possible. But the proof might not be very. If you don't understand, just ask me again. So I define a quantity F, which basically means I'm summing over all possible. I'm summing over 1 pi diagram, 2 1 pi diagram connected by a propagator, and all such things. Then F satisfies a recursive relation, which is a 1 pi diagram plus. So this is the recursive relation. You can have just a 1 pi part or a 1 pi part connected to F again, which means that F can be determined in terms of the self-energy diagram using this expression, right? Now, in order to prove the coordinate invariance, what we do is that we change the coordinate. We change the world shape coordinate. And if we do that, the only thing that will change is this F. And let's say F goes to delta F. This is the change. And here, we say that let's this change can be absorbed into an overall normalization, okay? And the claim is that the pole doesn't change is basically that this delta y doesn't have any pole at k square plus m square. Okay, if delta y has a pole, that means the pole has changed. But we will show that this delta y doesn't have any pole if we do this coordinate change, and if we will see So before I go prove this using these diagrams, let me first give you the physical picture. The physical picture will be this delta y will be this change in the 1 PI diagram due to the change of local choice of coordinate. And since this is just a change of 1 PI diagram, it's by definition free from poles. Okay, so that we will prove it, but you will see that's basically what delta y gives. So let's try to prove it. So under the change of local choice of coordinate, the vertex operator just picks up a value which is proportional to k square plus m square. This tilde v is not important, but this schematic structure is one can easily understand because we know when we take the on-shell limit, there is no such change. So any change will be proportional to k square plus m square. Now this change in the delta f or delta in the 1 PI in the self energy diagram in the optional 2-point function will come just if we replace the original vertex operator if we replace the vertex operator by its change, then we can evaluate the change in the 1 PI diagram.
That formula is up to BRST transformation, up to BRST
exactly. No, because this is. So this vertex operator is BRST exact when you take k square plus m square equals to 0. So this is, I think it's an exact statement. It's not.
The right hand side, you have plus q of
something. Okay, you can think it as in a q of something, but I'm not thinking as a BRST transformation. I'm just saying that let's consider this vertex operator inserted at this local choice of coordinate. And let's change the local choice of coordinate. Don't think it as a BRST transformation. Think that you are changing the local choice of coordinate around the punctures.
Yeah, I think it's a part of the art. Using a canonical choice where it's a primary of
yes.
It's not a general vertex.
Yes, we just took it to be off shell by just by deforming case by just going away from k square percent. So then if that is true, then any change will be proportional to k square plus m square because we know that on-shell amplitude is well defined and independent of local choice of coordinate. Okay, so then this change will also come from just putting this vertex operator vi tilde in this diagram. So here we put originally we computed just using original vertex operator, but if we want to consider the change, we just replace one vertex operator by its change. Okay, so then that means that delta f or delta the change of the self energy delta pi is also proportional to k square plus m square, right? And in this way, j is all free from by the definition it's free from the pole at k square plus m square. So we use these definitions and the point is that we use these definitions and we put it here, this expression, to get this algebraic relation. Okay. Now let's try to do that. Let's explain it once again. So f is, as I defined, is this diagram. It's a 1 PI and this 1 PI connected to f again. So change in f, which is denoted by h, is replacing a vertex operator by its change. And you do the same thing here and here. And if we do that, then this diagrammatic equation says that h is this quantity, this change here and change in this part. Now compare this equation with the equation I got here. If you equate it, you get that the change delta y is proportional to j, which is the change of the 1 PI diagram. Mm-hmm. So the delta y we got two slides back here. We claimed that the change in the amplitude can be thought as a change in the normalization, but in this process we haven't assumed anything about delta y. We wanted to show that delta y is free from pole, and just by considering this diagrammatic equation, we proved that delta y is free from pole. It's just the change of the 1 PI diagram. Okay. So that's the proof essentially. That's the proof in the simplest setup. I will talk about more complex situations, but essentially it's the same thing. And this result, as Ashok described, it's in the string field theory. It's basically two different choice of local coordinates. Is basically can be thought as a field redefinition of the string field theory. It was proven by Zwieback and Hata in 1993, and Ashok proved it last year in this one PI superstring field theory. So that was the simplest setup, but in string theory, if we want to do it, we have more problems. And the problem is that you have many states. You have large degeneracy of physical, unphysical, and pure gauge state at every energy level in string theory. Okay, and under the loop correction, the physical state will start mixing with unphysical states. In the simplest gauge theory, that doesn't happen. But in a complicated enough gauge theory, we actually gave an example in our second paper. In a complicated enough gauge theory, the physical state can start mixing with unphysical states. If that happens, we know that only the mass of the physical state are independent of the gauge, but the mass of the unphysical state and the pure gauge state do depend on the choice of gauge. So if we have such a situation in string theory, then we will run into the trouble. There'll be some more trouble in the proof we just gave. So the way we solve it is that we first modify the definition of the physical state order by order. And we define it in a way such that the mixing between the physical state and the unphysical state vanishes. So we compute the mixing first, then we diagonalized in such a way that the mixing between physical and the unphysical state vanishes. We then use this modified definition of physical state, and sorry, this should be physical mass, to determine the physical mass. That's the procedure for general state. So let's explain it once again. So the way we did it is that first, in our first paper, we considered some special vertex operators. And these special vertex operators are vertex operators which belong to some irreducible representation of the symmetry group, such that there is no unphysical vertex operator at that mass level.
What is unphysical?
Sorry?
What is unphysical?
So, let's consider the first massive level in heterotic string theory. You have these massive states, but you have more unphysical states in your theory.
Non-Bierstein.
Berendt. So, and no one says that when you go off-shell, no one guarantees you that you won't have any mixing. So the first thing we did is that we chose some special states, which we call special states, which never mix with unphysical state at the same mass level because of their group theory property. Okay, and then if that is true, then we can the procedure I just described works very well, and you can determine the mass renormalization for the special states easily. And now once you have this setup, actually you can show that any other states in string theory can be obtained as a pole term in the nth matrix element of the massless BPS of special states. Okay, so the special state can never be obtained as a pole of the massless sector, but once you have the massless S matrix element for the massless sector, BPS sector, and special states, you can determine all the mass of any other state but just by looking at the pole of this S matrix element. So that was the constraint. Sorry, I haven't given the proof, but the point is that if you now use this mass, so if you first determine the pole here in this slide, and now if you use this mass to truncate the S matrix element at this proper value of the mass, you can show that the S matrix element is well defined, and is also independent of the local choice of coordinate. It's a proof similar to this proof, but it's more. It contains more algebraic equations. Yes?
Now that you mentioned the first mass level, uh-huh. Do you think you can give us a schematic idea on how these quantities delta y and h and j look like if I put two states from the first mass level into two quantities?
Yeah, so that's an explicit computation we want to finish some time, but we haven't done it yet. So we want to compute the mass renormalization for the SO32 spin-off states in heterotic string theory. explicitly. So the while loop computation, I think, has already been done by Ashok. And that, but all these complexities will actually more severe in the two loop level. And we want to, we hope to do it at some point, but we haven't done it yet. So that this is like the end of the first part, which discussed the mass renormalization. If you have any question, otherwise I'll go and discuss the problem with the vacuum shift within this pragmatic approach. Okay, so let's go and discuss the problem with the shifting of vacuum in string theory. So as Ashok described already, that there are some supersymmetric compactification down to 4 dimension, n equals 1 theory in 4 dimension, 3 plus 1 dimension, where E1 gauge fields receives, there is a Fayette-Leopoldis term generated at the one loop, and it generates a dilaton tadpole at the two loop. So there is a general proof in superstring theory that if you have unbroken supersymmetry up to G loop, then you can prove that you will have, you will not have any dilaton tadpole, or the vacuum energy will be non-zero up to that order. But here in this case, you will see that there's explicit computation was done in the 80s that you get, you generate this term and you can show that there will be a dilaton, there will be a non-zero two loop vacuum energy that was also recently been computed in these papers. So the point is that we know this problem, but if we arrive at this problem, what to do with string theory? How do you shift the vacuum in string theory? So one way is obviously what Ashok already described, is to consider superstring 1pi effective action. But we can do, so this is another, this is the way to deal with this problem in a pragmatic approach, where we don't discuss any language of superstring field theory, but you can still do things and compute. So the correct procedure is to now quantize string theory around this new vacuum. But however, this new vacuum is not a solution of the classical equation of motion, and hence conformally invariant wall sheet theory is not suitable for carrying out systematic perturbation around this new background. Okay, so we will again go back to our lessons in quantum field theory, and we'll try to generalize some concepts in field theory, some concepts in string theory. So the field theory time model is, suppose we have a scalar field theory, which has a 5-4 interaction, tree-level 5-4 interaction. It generates a negative correction, loop correction generates a negative mass term for it. And in field theory, we minimize the one loop effective potential, and we expect the physical minima to be at this value. Now we expand the action around this minima and compute physical quantity around the new vacuum. And this was done in this famous paper by Coleman and Weinberg. And the basic observation from field theory is that when you expand fields around the new vacuum, firstly, there is no tachyon in the spectrum. There is no non-zero tadpole. And thirdly, this was done in the 1968, I think, that the Feynman diagram around the new vacuum can be written as an infinite set of Feynman diagrams around the old vacuum, which means that this lambda is, say, the vacuum expectation value for the scalar field. And let's say you want to compute the endpoint function around the new vacuum, where the vacuum expectation value is lambda. Then the amplitude around the new vacuum can be computed as a sum of infinite number of diagrams around the old vacuum. This is the diagram you compute around the old vacuum, where vacuum expectation value is zero. And you also start increasing the number of external states, and all these external states are like tadpoles. They're tadpoles going into the vacuum. Okay, and diagrammatically, this is something like this. Let's say you want to compute two-point function around the new vacuum, which will be the ordinary two-point function around the old vacuum. Then you will have this four-point function around the old vacuum, where two of the external states goes into vacuum. Okay, you also have this six-point function where four of the states actually goes. These are zero-momentum tadpoles which goes into the vacuum. And you will have many more diagrams. You will have even loop diagrams in here. So we take this lesson, and we add in the Polyakov action, we add this new term. This is the vertex operator for the dilaton field at the zero momentum. And we define the amplitude around the new vacuum to be the vertex operator with this new coherent state factor, with this new factor which we introduced to sift the vacuum. So this is what we do. But at this point, you might ask me that what is the value of lambda? How do you determine lambda? Because you don't know any, you don't have any one particle irreducible action. You haven't said how to determine lambda. Okay, the way to determine lambda is to use our string field theory intuition. And this will be determined order by order in perturbation theory, just by demanding that there is no massless dipole around the new vacuum. So at this point, with this ad hoc definition, ad hoc value of lambda, this will have tadpoles. The one-point function will be non-zero around the new vacuum. But we will fix the value of lambda just by demanding that there will be no tadpole around the new vacuum. Okay, and then we will put the value of lambda for other point function, two and higher point functions to determine the amplitudes around the new vacuum. That's our approach. So just to give you a simple calculation, how can you see that? How can you see this is actually giving a sensible result? I'll show that this result, which I proved here in the field theory toy model, you can actually reproduce this by this new method. And the way to see this is that let's consider a tadpole around the new vacuum. This is a tadpole, which is I denoted by this bold line. And this can be this will contain infinite number of diagrams, but I have just drawn here the first two diagrams. The first diagram will be a four-point function where the three of the legs are actually these spurious tadpoles. These tadpoles, zero-momentum tadpoles going into the vacuum. This is a tree-level diagram, and this is a one-loop diagram, which is essentially the self-energy of the states at the zero momentum. Okay, now. You want to say that this one-point function vanishes, which basically means that you demand this quantity is equal to zero. If you do that, and if you put all the values I have in for the field theory time model, you will find that you get the same value of lambda. Actually, there is a small subtlety. The small subtlety is that there is the value of lambda equals to zero is possible at this stage, but we know that lambda equals to zero is not a solution because we have tachyonic mass there. So once we discuss the solution lambda equals to zero, there are other two solutions, which is effectively this two solutions in case of Coleman-Weinberg potential. So we do this order by order in perturbation theory. This requires cancellation between different loop orders, and in this way we can evaluate the vacuum expectation value of the scalar field phi in all orders perturbatively. We do this computation perturbatively order by order in G string. But there is more difficulty in string theory. And the difficulty is that, as I said here, that you need to compute this arbitrary number of tadpole insertions from this. But if you want to do it in string theory, you know that, again, the same kind of problem. You have this one PR region. Let's say you want to compute two-loop three-point function around the new vacuum. Then one diagram that contributes to the two-loop three-point function will be this diagram where you have, say, four tadpoles going into the vacuum. But if you have four tadpoles, you have a certain degeneration where one part of the momentum flowing through this node is zero, which means that this diagram diverges. So we have to cut off near the boundary of the moduli space. And the way we do it is that we regulate the integral near the boundary of the moduli space. We put an infrared cutoff there, okay, which is effectively saying that this the length of this handle cannot go to infinite length. We truncate it at some finite value. But then we combine this contribution at a given order in tree string, and then we remove the regulator. So once we do the computation with this regulator. We compute the vacuum expectation value with this regulator. But at the end of the day, when we want to compute the amplitude, we need to remove the regulator and want to show that it's independent of the regulator. And there is one more subtlety here, that the regulator is actually depends on local choice of coordinates, because the decomposition of the moduli space depends on the local choice of coordinate. And the result is that the S matrix element and the physical quantity, other physical quantity, has a finite limit when you take this infinite cutoff to infinity. And there is a physical way to understand it. The physical way is that first we put the cutoff, but before, let's look at the diagram which where you have this problem. This is basically the problem with the tadpoles, right? So once you have put the cutoff and then determine the vacuum expectation value, you know that this type of diagram will be zero. So you first regulate the diagram, and then after determining the vacuum expectation value, this part of the amplitude will be zero. So the regulator will multiply something zero, and then when if you take the cutoff to infinity, the answer will be insensitive to the cutoff. So we did that. We showed that S matrix element and then the other physical quantities has finite limit, and we basically it's true because the fact is that we determine the value of lambda, we determine the vacuum expectation value with the demand that the tadpole vanishes. So we expect it to be true. But surprisingly, this amount of shift lambda actually depends on the local choice of coordinate. So if you determine the vacuum expectation value with the cutoff, we'll find that the vacuum expectation value of the scalar field actually depends on the local choice of coordinate. And that's at the face value, it looks surprising because we haven't came across any such thing in quantum field theory. We know the vacuum expectation value as a meaning. But actually, if you think that what we determine in a physical experiment is basically the scattering around the new vacuum. We don't evaluate the vacuum expectation value. And again, the vacuum expectation value doesn't have any physical meaning in the sense is that if you do a field redefinition, the vacuum expectation value changes. And as I already explained to you, that this change in the local choice of coordinate is effectively in the string field theory language. It's a redefinition of the string field, which basically says that then the vacuum expectation value should change under local choice of coordinate. And one can show that the S matrix, but though this value of lambda actually depends here, but the S matrix element around the new vacuum is independent of the local choice of coordinate. So if I get time later, I can try to prove it, but I haven't proved it here, that there is a nice cancellation between the change in the vacuum expectation value and the definition of the one particle irreducible diagram. Okay, and as Ashok has already described, this up to this point, whatever I have done is the most simplest thing, which is the bosonic string theory. We know in bosonic string theory there is a problem with the tachyon, but we ignored that problem because it was kind of a toy model for us to understand what to do for superstrings. And the thing you generalize for the superstring is that you now have to consider local choice around the picture changing operators, and there is also a corresponding problem in choosing the section because of this problem of non-splitness of the supermoduli space and the corresponding subtlety to the choice of integration cycle, but that has already been done in this two paper. So in conclusion, the point is that even if you don't have the heavy machinery of BV formalism and string field theory, this pragmatic way of defining official amplitude in string theory is effective in computing mass renormalization and shifting the vacuum. And as Oliver has already asked me, that there is possible some future direction is that first to compute, say, give an explicit value in principle, which should be that if we can do that integral, we want to write an integral in the genus 2 moduli space for the two loop mass renormalization for the SO32 spinor state in the first massive level. That's one thing one can try doing. And second thing is that this story should have some generalization in open string theory, where you will have this problem, but you will have different. So in the open string theory, you have the open string degenerations and you also have closed string degenerations. So, but the story should not be very it should not be a million miles away from this procedure, but one has to carefully understand that, so that it should be possible to understand the similar issues in open string theory. And that's all.